Alan Moore and Frank Miller, each decried one repercussion of their own work. Darkness spread through superhero comics. Satire shaped the source. It was in this climate that the Road to Perdition author Max Allan Collins wrote Jason Todd's post-crisis origin. Out went the happy-go-lucky circus kid. In his place, this new history delivers a cigarette-smoking street urchin in the process of boosting the Batmobile's tires the first time Batman meets him. Readers disliked this new Jason Todd. Dick Grayson, pre-crisis, chooses his own time to give up the mantle of Robin and take on a more mature role. He passes the Robin torch to his successor by introducing Jason Number One into Batman's life, and when the time comes for Jason to take over as Batman's official partner, gives Jason a Robin costume and encourages him to assume the name. Post-crisis, Batman unceremoniously fires an injured Dick Grayson and forbids him from using the Robin name. Readers considered this new version of the story and Jason Todd's nature to be an insult to Dick Grayson in every way. No longer identified with the first Robin as his anointed successor, this second Robin instead becomes his usurper. Discovering the reader's dislike of new Jason, the writers played to it, making Jason progressively brattier over the next year. Readers voted to kill Jason Todd. Although a slight majority of individual respondents apparently voted to spare this boy wonder, it seems that some enthusiastic voters, whether driven by sheer hatred of the character or by the feeling of power over determining the outcome, repeatedly voted off with his head. Maintaining someone else's status quo might not foster a feeling of power the way forcing a change can. People like to see that they matter, that they exert real influence on the world outside themselves. Those high in need for power, NPOW, especially so. See Case File 6-1, Bane. The second issue in DC Comics' Batman story, A Death in the Family, ended with Jason possibly dying in an explosion. A vote via 900 numbers determined the outcome, and 2 weeks later, the world learned Robin was dead. Much of the public, generally unaware that the comics had a new Robin, thought the original had died. Numerous news reports and even the documentary Batmania, From Comics to Screen, erroneously reported Dick Grayson dead. Bob Kane hated the stunt. The Dark Knight Returns author Frank Miller expressed utter disgust. An actual toll-free number where fans can call in to put the axe to a little boy's head? To me, the whole killing of Robin thing was probably the ugliest thing I've seen in comics, and the most cynical. More than 16 years after Jason's published death, he would return from the dead as an anti-hero and enemy. See Case File 10-1, Red Hood. Tim Drake. In light of Jason Todd's reader-dictated demise, writer Marv Wolfman returned to elements that had worked when Jerry Conway introduced the original Jason. He went to the circus. Preschooler Tim Drake witnesses the Flying Grayson's deaths, an event that gives him nightmares for years. Upon later realizing that Dick Grayson has become Robin, Tim deduces Batman's identity and extrapolates from there. Years pass. Jason Todd dies. Batman fights on without Robin, but is now harder, more violent, wearier, and less careful, injuring himself more frequently than before. 13-year-old Tim tries to convince Dick Grayson that Batman needs Grayson to become Robin again, but instead himself becomes the third Robin. The first time Bruce meets Tim, as had also been the case with Jason Number One, Tim's in a Robin costume. Like Barbara Gordon, the original Batgirl, Tim initially dons cape and mask not because of any personal tragedy, not out of any need for vengeance, but because he has skills, and putting them to use helping others seems like the right thing to do. Tim wants to become the world's greatest detective. For Tim and Barbara, crime fighting starts out as a form of altruism, unselfishly helping others despite risk and cost to oneself. Tim is smart and friendly, a good partner who takes orders well, a strong leader for the new class of Teen Titans, and in the real world, a popular character. Dick Grayson was always so perfect in every way, said comic book writer Chuck Dixon. And of course, Jason Todd was too imperfect. Tim Drake is sort of in the middle. I feel like he's a real teenager. Figures in Tim's life keep dying, because that's how superhero comic books work, with some coming back from the dead because that's also how comic books work. Instead of playing Robin at Dick Grayson's side while others believe Bruce is dead, Tim takes the name Red Robin and quests for proof that Bruce lives, and then continues under the new name following his adoptive father's return. After Tim, there would be no more trips to the circus to shop for new sidekicks. Future Robins would, like Jason Number 2, come from the children of criminals. Stephanie Brown. The daughter of a lesser-known bat foe called the Clue Master, high schooler Stephanie Brown dons a purple costume as the spoiler to spoil her father's crimes. With some training from Batman, she continues fighting evil. Tim Drake becomes her sometimes boyfriend before she finds herself pregnant from a prior relationship. The ex-boyfriend having left Gotham after a cataclysmic earthquake wrecked the city, Stephanie goes ahead with the pregnancy without him. Tim helps, providing support and coaching her in Lamaze classes. In the end, she gives up the child for adoption. Through Stephanie, the Robin series addressed teenage pregnancy and adoption sensitively and somewhat realistically, while also stirring controversy for covering them at all. That controversy, however, paled in comparison to the maelstrom over Stephanie's death. When Tim Drake's father orders him to quit being Robin, Stephanie insists on taking up the Robin mantle. Though wary, having previously deemed her too reckless and unskilled to fight crime, Batman briefly makes her his first girl wonder, only to fire her for disobeying him in two missions. Unlike the boys' wonder, all created to suit that narrative need for Batman to have a partner he can talk to, Stephanie became Robin to serve a different storytelling function, to give her upcoming death more impact. Having already decided to kill her off soon, the creative team first made her a Robin for three issues. In the chaos of a citywide gang war, the Black Mask tortures Stephanie, trying to extract information about Batman, but she escapes. Before succumbing to those injuries, Stephanie in her hospital bed asks Bruce, "Was I ever really Robin?" Despite having evaded Alfred's accusation that he'd let her play Robin only as a ruse to manipulate Tim Drake, Batman assures her, "Of course you were." And soon she dies. Ah, but Stephanie's wounds had not been severe enough to kill her, after all. When Batman tries to determine why Stephanie died, Bruce Wayne's maternal figure, Dr. Leslie Tompkins, claims to have killed the girl by purposely withholding medical treatment that would have kept her alive, sacrificing Stephanie's life supposedly to teach Batman to stop involving children in his war on crime. Fans howled because murder was wholly out of character for benevolent as Mother Teresa, loving humanitarian Leslie Tompkins. By establishing that Stephanie should have survived, though, that story inadvertently set things up for her return under another writer. Chuck Dixon brought Stephanie back by staying true to the character's personalities. As it turns out, Leslie has actually made a supreme act of altruism by giving up her medical practice, her reputation, her worldly possessions, and the life she had in Gotham in order to fake Stephanie's death and help the girl escape the chaos. Leslie heads to Africa, where she and Stephanie help the needy. Only after Stephanie returns to fight Gotham's crime again does Leslie come home. Why would a criminal's child become a crime fighter in the first place? At its most basic, Stephanie does so as her own teenage rebellion. She fights crime to fight her father. Teens rebel for many reasons, not the least of which is to say, "I'm not you." Individuality consists of two dimensions: self-assertion, the ability to have and express a point of view, and separateness, perception and expression of how that person is different from others. Even as the maturing adolescent needs individuality, he or she still needs to feel connected to others. By assuming her spoiler identity, Stephanie names herself for her efforts to spoil the Clue Master's crimes, conveying both distinctiveness from and yet connectedness to her criminal father. She becomes spoiler out of anger. Between his long incarcerations and time spent planning and committing robberies, his Clue Master activities have directly kept him from being there for her as a father. Where other youths might commit crimes as their way of acting out, Stephanie acts out by stopping them. Along the way, though, she discovers that she enjoys being a hero, and heroism becomes part of her blooming personality. Of course, she's also defying her other parent by running off on these adventures without her mother's knowledge, much less her permission. Some might consider Stephanie's early sexual activity and resultant pregnancy to be a form of acting out, too. Teens whose fathers have been absent exhibit higher pregnancy rates. Even though Stephanie becomes Batgirl instead of Spoiler for a while, her final act as Batgirl before Barbara Gordon resumes the role is to spoil her father's criminal activity one more time. Damian Wayne. Ra's al Ghul marries the Caped Crusader to Al Ghul's daughter Talia al Ghul, without our hero's consent, but within the law of that unnamed land. The graphic novel, Son of the Demon, left readers fascinated by the possibility that somewhere out in the world, Bruce might have a son from that marriage. In that story, his pregnant bride Talia grows to fear that Batman's overprotective manner makes him vulnerable and will surely get him killed. So she tells him she has miscarried. They agree to end the marriage and he goes home. Later, however, she gives birth to their son, whom she gives up for adoption. In 2006, author Grant Morrison reintroduced the child as an 8-year-old boy, Damian. Talia presents Damian to Bruce to distract Batman from interfering with a kidnapping plot she has in the works. Damian has spent his short life alternately spoiled like a young prince and rigidly disciplined by assassins training him. Whether Bruce really is the father, and for that matter, whether Talia really is the mother, goes unconfirmed. For all we readers know, Damian is really her nephew or little brother. Her own father, Ra's, might not know the truth. Bruce tells Tim he knows Damian's parentage, and yet does not tell Tim what that means. "Tim, I know the kid's very tough to be around," Bruce explains. "He was raised by international terrorists in his grandfather's League of Assassins. Brutalized, indoctrinated, then used as a weapon in his mother's insane war on me. If he is my son, even if he is not, he deserves some love and respect." Damian is a deadly little boy. He kills, in fact beheads, a criminal called the Spook, and nearly kills Tim, because that's how they did things in the League of Assassins. Damian tells Tim that, "We showed our enemies no mercy. Now that I'm here, he doesn't need a surrogate. We killed anyone who got in our way." More than any other Robin, Damian is too dangerous to leave unguided. During a period when people think Bruce is dead, Dick becomes Batman, 10-year-old Damian becomes Robin, and roles get reversed, with a more upbeat Batman leading a dark little Robin. Loath as Damian is to admit any weakness, he pines for his father's attention. When Bruce at last returns to Gotham, the time comes for Batman and son to fight crime together, with Batman in the position of needing to temper both himself and this newest Robin. Crime-fighting value. A superhero could use a partner for the same reasons a police officer does. The partner has your back. Working with a partner, you can watch multiple exits, improve the odds against multiple foes, or outnumber a criminal who works alone, and be in more than one location at the same time. One can aid the other as a lookout or scout. The senior partner learns by teaching, reinforcing his own strengths, and maybe coming to understand his abilities better through the process of articulating them to someone else. The junior partner provides different knowledge, additional skills, an alternate point of view, a sounding board to help the senior think, and someone to complete the job's more menial duties. Having an apprentice benefits the master, as it has throughout the ages. The child's sidekick could fit through smaller spaces, infiltrate groups a grown man could not, and play roles like the newsboy hawking papers right under hoodlums' noses. With a child, The duo's division of authority and responsibilities is clear. The young partner offers the promise that the hero might create a long-term crime-fighting legacy. The master initiates the apprentice into the trade. Cusp of adolescence initiation rites promote identity foreclosure, forming a lifetime commitment before one is old enough to analyze the choice. The apprentice will carry on the work with the expectation that one day the apprentice will succeed the master. Personal value. Working with others can make Batman more cautious, more conscious of the big picture and what's going on outside his personal space. It keeps him sharp because he has someone else to watch out for and to fit into that big picture. Batman gets injured less often when he has a Robin. For a hero who expects never to settle down and raise a family, taking on a sidekick helps fulfill any paternal needs he might nevertheless feel. Pederasty? Despite Frederick Wortham's serious assertion that Batman and Robin's lifestyle is a homosexual fantasy and popular, usually not serious, speculations about homosexual or pedophilic subtext, the creators intended nothing of the sort. Kane considered Wortham perverted for even thinking such a thing. See Case File 10-2, Dr. Frederick Wortham. Wish fulfillment. Vicariously, Batman can experience wish fulfillment by letting the boy experience things Bruce had only wished for, starting with closure. He helps the boy get the justice young Bruce didn't. In their first adventure, the original dynamic duo take down the gangster who had Dick's parents killed. Beyond that, Batman gives each Robin the mentor he himself didn't have and a father figure who's not on the payroll. With them all, he endeavors to provide mentorship of a kind Alfred couldn't give and let them enjoy their youth more than he ever did. Identification. Robins look like Bruce. Specifically, they look like young, newly orphaned Bruce Wayne. Identification reminds Bruce why he does this, to keep others from suffering what he once suffered. He goes out to serve the kid he once was. Identification provides a connection to his inner child, before his parents died, when they died, and afterward. When Tim Drake first shows up at Wayne Manor, trying to convince Dick to become Robin again, Tim says, "Dick, don't you see? He needs Robin. He needs him to remember what he used to be, before his parents died." The first time Batman meets Richard Grayson, and the boy wants to join him in fighting crime, Batman thinks back to the time when his parents, too, were innocent victims of a criminal. His identification with this boy gives him a connection to the murders themselves. He relies on reminders like that. Dick reminds Bruce of his own 8-year-old self, whereas the other Robins often remind Bruce of Dick Grayson. Dick, as the oldest son, doesn't have to live up to anyone else's example. The younger brothers all feel like they're expected to live up to his. Growing up Robin. Birth order. One of psychotherapist Alfred Adler's enduring contributions to psychology is the notion that order of birth exerts powerful influence over social and personality development. Although empirical research varies in the degree to which it supports Adler's specific details, he nevertheless understood birth order enough that he could regularly amaze party guests by guessing their birth order based on their behavior. Birth order, while not mandating one's entire identity, exerts some influence. To what degree it shapes personality, psychologists endlessly debate. Every Robin lives his or her earliest years, like Bruce himself, as an only child with no siblings. An only child, spending more time in the company of adults than would a kid with siblings, often matures earlier and manifests more adult attitudes and actions, except that the only child doesn't learn as well to share or compete. Accustomed to being the center of parental attention, depending on the quality and quantity of that attention, only children may find themselves disappointed in areas of life outside the home unless their skills happen to be particularly outstanding. A firstborn child faces dethronement, the loss of that special position from having been the only child. parental attention and affection now get divided. Age diminishes this effect. The older the firstborn is when the second comes along, the less he or she feels dethroned. A wide gap in age lets the firstborn retain the sense of being the number one child. Dick Grayson is grown before any other Robins come along. In fact, it is he who originally introduces both Jason Todd, pre-crisis, and Tim Drake as his successors. Every Robin experiences dethronement by merit of having been the birth family's only child, who becomes instead part of the Bat family, in which only Dick gets to be the firstborn. The secondborn child, whose arrival caused such upheaval for the firstborn, always has that firstborn as an example to follow or fight. Seeing the older sibling as a role model, as competition, or even as a threat, tends to make the secondborn the most competitive child in the family, trying to avoid feeling eclipsed by the elder. This need to compete can be crushed, however, by an older sibling who excels even compared to peers. Jason Todd, the second-born Robin, feels daunted by Dick Grayson's stellar example. When Jason's murder goes unavenged, he has to wonder, after his resurrection, of course, if Bruce would have avenged Dick. Jason doesn't give Tim Drake much thought. He gives Dick plenty. Even researchers who consider birth order important recognize that birth order effects become harder to predict as the family continues to grow. Dynamics within the family become more and more complicated. When Jason returns to Gotham, he discovers he has been replaced by Tim, effectively making Jason the middle son. The middle-born child, who lacks special status as either the eldest or the youngest, can feel like the neglected birth order. While Jason carves out his new niche as the black sheep of the family, he nevertheless shows characteristics some researchers have observed among the middle-born. More jealousy, less healthy self-esteem, less inclination to help family, and less affiliation with family in general. With violent anti-hero Jason estranged from Batman, Tim becomes the middle son, among those still welcome in the Batcave, once Damian enters the picture. And as soon as Dick and Damian start spending time together, Tim becomes Red Robin and strikes off on his own. The youngest or last-born child may be more mature than peers because of time spent with older siblings and their friends, or less mature if babied by the family. No one gets pampered in the Bat family. Tim Drake briefly loses his position as the youngest child during Stephanie Brown's short stint as Robin, and permanently when Damian arrives, compounding the difficulties an adoptive child faces when a child who is blood kin comes along. Even before Damian becomes a Robin, his apparent status as Bruce's biological son changes Tim's status. Damian, who wants to be seen as the only child, feels insecure about that, resents the others, and doesn't want to share with them. Tim, as the non-biological son, may feel usurped by this newcomer. When an older child is adoptive, the younger one often feels he or she should be seen as the most worthy, even teasing the elder with, "I'm their real child, not you," to compensate for feelings that the adoptive child has been chosen, directly selected based on his or her own circumstances and qualities, to become that parent's child, whereas the biological child has not. When Tim asks why Damian acts like such a jerk, the boy tells him, "Because you don't deserve any of this. You're adopted. But when you're gone, I'll take my rightful place at my father's side, as Batman's son. I'll inherit everything." Throughout history, many later-born princes have seen older brothers as obstacles to the throne. Dick, in accepting Jason and then Tim, shows little sign of feeling dethroned. He has already relinquished the Robin role and moved into his adult life before the little brothers start showing up. When he, Bruce's first adoptive son, becomes Batman in Bruce's absence, though, he shows some signs of dethronement around Damian, allegedly Bruce's first biological heir. Repeatedly calling the boy a brat to his face, Dick regresses a bit, acting less like a mature father figure and more like a teenage son who resents having to babysit a little stepbrother. Psychosocial stages. Batman, as we know him, skips the steps of growing up. He's a child whose parents die. And then he's a crime-fighting hero, with scant attention to the years in between. While this suits Sigmund Freud's view that personality takes shape early in childhood, psychodynamic contemplation of the lives of Batman's sidekicks could benefit from Erik Erikson's more elaborate stage theory. Freud said little about adolescence. Mentored by Sigmund's daughter, Anna Freud, who pioneered adolescent psychology as a distinct area of study, Erikson continued to call himself a loyal Freudian, even as his ideas departed substantially from Freud's psychoanalytic foundations. Sigmund Freud and Bruce Wayne, like other mentors and father figures throughout the ages, each watched their students take the lessons they've learned and build them into something new. Instead of seeing sex drive as the impetus behind personality development, Erikson felt that interactions with our fellow human beings shape us more than anything else. Hence his theory of psychosocial stages of development, as opposed to Freud's psychosexual stages. He also didn't believe personality is mostly fixed by age 6. The middle childhood and adolescent stages showed more active personality development than Freud had observed, and Erikson added adult stages as well. More optimistic than Freud, Erikson believed our personalities grow and change throughout our whole lives. Before Bruce loses his parents and before any of the Robins meet him, they've each completed the earliest psychosocial stages and have developed important aspects of their respective personalities. Early in life, Bruce and Tim learn to trust their parents. Dick, who spends even more time with his parents, is more optimistic, hopeful, and trusting. Whereas newly orphaned Bruce is wary of adults who take an interest in him and his inheritance, Dick is immediately ready to trust police and a masked stranger who dresses like Dracula. Even though Stephanie and Jason have learned that people like their loving but criminal fathers will let them down, the mothers who've raised them demonstrated that reliable people do exist and people can make themselves overcome their own failings, as when Stephanie's mother overcomes drug addiction. And so they both have hope, even if Jason's takes a dangerous turn. Least trusting of them all is Damien, the one raised by servants and assassins, and yet even that cynical child still hopes others will prove themselves worthy. According to Erikson, they would have all developed these various and sometimes conflicting tendencies during the first year and a half of life in the trust versus mistrust stage, depending on how consistently their primary caregivers met the infant's physical, emotional, and social needs. A favorable outcome in one stage gives the individual abilities and characteristics that raise the odds of achieving favorable outcomes in subsequent stages as well. Toddlerhood carries the individual through the autonomy versus shame and doubt stage, when the child learns to feel good and secure about doing things on his or her own, autonomously, or learns to feel unsure about acting independently, whether feeling shame, self-conscious about doing something bad, or doubt, uncertainty about one's own ability to function independently. The struggle to develop autonomy can result in a weak will overburdened by shame, a strong but healthy will, or shameless willfulness as the insecure person tries too hard to assert independence. The extreme defiance individuals can show during adolescence grows from roots planted back during the terrible twos. The Batcave reeks of strong wills. Every Robin defies Batman at times, but usually within the range of healthy self-assertion, because sometimes their grim mentor needs people to stand up to him. Insecure Jason's unresolved grief over his parents leads him to become progressively defiant and distant, mistaking distance for autonomy, whereas a secure person can feel independent without cutting others off. Damien is willful all along, and yet bows in shame when Bruce chastises him. You dishonor your sensei with your loss of composure. Stephanie, despite carrying some self-doubt and constructing her original spoiler identity to radiate her separateness from her father instead of ignoring him, possesses enough healthy autonomous qualities to help her mature into a young woman capable of operating independently and working with others, even Damien. In the initiative versus guilt stage of the later preschool years, roughly ages 3 to 6, the child develops a greater sense of purpose, learning to think ahead and undertake new tasks, even if the child's approach is not yet logical. Guilt, a new emotion, creeps in as the child becomes increasingly conscious of moral concerns. Bruce's decision to become Batman shows great initiative, as does Stephanie's to become Spoiler. Not satisfied with reading about Batman on the news after Jason dies, Tim Drake takes it upon himself to head for Wayne Manor and try to recreate a dynamic duo. Batman and all Robins show great initiative in taking on challenges, forming plans, and developing strategies. They all show hero initiative. While they also show varying capacities for guilt, they'll let it inspire them instead of holding them back. Dick and Damian first meet Batman when each boy is about the same age Bruce was when he lost his parents. Dick trains for months, and Damian has 2 years of additional experiences before becoming Robin. But each is well within the industry versus inferiority stage when he officially becomes Batman's sidekick. During this time, interpersonal awareness, deductive reasoning, and ability to play by rules can flourish. Parents, instructors, and in this case mentors, determine how well the children perceive their own growth. When Dick's training begins, Bruce praises the boy's acrobat skill, telling Dick, "You could probably teach me a thing or two." The first time Bruce sees Damian perform as Robin, he assures this boy, who so clearly aches for parental attention and approval, "You made the right choices. I'm proud of you." Even Dick, however much Damian's arrogance might annoy him, doles out positive reinforcement for his sidekick's more astute deductions and better decisions. Entering the Caped Crusade at such a young age, each has constructed his own sense of competence around his related interests, talents, and skills. Although he could later redefine himself during the identity crisis of adolescence, for him to do so entirely would mean abandoning the foundation for his personal sense of self-efficacy. A young Tiger Woods could have decided, "I'm going to give up this golf game I'm so good at." But not easily. Of the various Robins, fear of feeling inferior may exert its greatest influence on Damian, however superficially ironic that may seem. In Dick's case, he had no previous Robin to whom he could compare himself. Damian is the first since Dick to become Robin this early in life. Damian's often arrogant manner suggests that he has been taught that he's supposed to feel superior without receiving guidance regarding the healthier aspects of self-esteem. Jason, Tim, and Stephanie are all adolescents early in Erickson's identity achievement versus role confusion stage when they start fighting crime. Having already developed their overall sense of competence and industry, they are now trying to figure out who they are as individual human beings. During this time, the youth forms his or her self-image, integrating ideas about self and what others think of them, with expanding awareness of his or her place in the world. Shaping identity is difficult, complicated, and sometimes stressful beyond explanation. Those who emerge from this stage form a strong sense of identity, though continuing to grow and add to that identity, and are better equipped to face adulthood with confidence and security. Dick and Tim, having enjoyed the most support and healthiest development all along the way, are the Robins who can most easily become stable adults. Peers play a critical role in shaping personality and helping adolescents to find themselves. Aside from whatever high school experiences they live through in their civilian identities, Dick and Tim each enjoy the support of crime-fighting peers, the Teen Titans. Dick to Batman. Unlike the JLA, the Titans aren't just about a promise to the world. It's also about a promise to each other, to ourselves. We swore on our childhood nightmares that we'd be there for one another. If I don't honor that, I don't honor who I am. Individuals failing to achieve cohesive sense of self, those who continue to struggle with Erickson's identity crisis, or who have given up on figuring themselves out, show great confusion over their roles in life. That would be Jason Todd. Dying keeps him from growing up. Time in a grave, in a coma, and then brain damage before the Lazarus pit heals him mean he has missed out on his high school years. Physically, he may be grown, but emotionally he's barely any older than he was when the Joker first killed him. What lies ahead for the Robins? Growing into two capable youths, each with a strong sense of self, Stephanie and Tim should have many of the qualities that would help them fare well if they ever get to enter the next psychosocial stage, intimacy versus isolation, when those in their 20s and 30s either become increasingly capable of experiencing interpersonal intimacy with others or become psychologically isolated, cut off emotionally, and unable to open up. Aside from the sheer difficulty any superhero faces in achieving a balance between masked and civilian lives, the greatest impediment for Stephanie's future intimacy may lie not in any problem with herself, but in finding a compatible partner who can appreciate a strong and strong-willed woman. Many can, plenty cannot. The major obstacle for Tim should be his own guilt and fear that his lifestyle might bring harm to his loved ones, again. Playing superhero already brought his father's killer to the door. Jason Todd, who missed out on much of his own adolescence during his death, coma, and brain-damaged period, is far behind his peers in terms of personal growth. He has enjoyed the fewest opportunities to develop everyday social skills, and seems unlikely to have any semblance of a normal relationship. Finding someone with the kind of patience he needs will not be easy. Most likely, he will enter into relationships with women as volatile as himself, and their relationships will seem as explosive as gasoline mating with fire. Dick Grayson, the eldest Robin, has shown himself capable of long-term romantic relationships. Unfortunately for him, his lifestyle, plus the writer's need to keep the stories lively, keeps getting in the way. As he's about to marry longtime girlfriend Starfire, their minister gets murdered. Later, he becomes engaged to Barbara Gordon, but again, superheroics interfere. Nevertheless, he remains more likely than Bruce to enter successful intimate relationships. Bruce's personality is the first thing that interferes with his relationships. At least Dick Grayson goes for the good girls. Dick. Hold it. I've got one more thing to say. You and Alfred gave me a home, and you gave me what we don't mention. The L word. You were the best family I could have had. Thanks. Case File 10-1. Red Hood. Real name, Jason Peter Todd. First appearance, as Jason, Batman number 357, March 1983. As Robin, Batman number 368, February 1984. As Corpse, Batman number 428, Holiday 1988. As Red Hood, Batman number 635, December 2004. As Nightwing, Nightwing number 118, May 2006. As Red Robin, Countdown to Final Crisis number 17, January 2008. Origin. This version of Jason Todd, the son of a loving mother who dies of poor health and a small-time hoodlum whom Two-Face has murdered, is a street orphan stealing the Batmobile's tires when the Dark Knight first meets him. Lonely after Dick Grayson outgrows the Robin role and becomes Nightwing, Batman decides that Jason stands his best chance in life if Bruce Wayne adopts the boy. After Jason persists in trying to work on Batman's cases, Bruce teaches him to redirect his criminal skills into crime fighting. Though initially spunky, optimistic, and as gung-ho as Dick Grayson ever was, Jason turns increasingly distant, disrespectful, and disobedient. In one of his final appearances as Robin, he may have tossed a drug dealer to his death after the man, protected by diplomatic immunity, sadistically drives his abused girlfriend to suicide. He slipped, Jason claims. When Jason soon discovers that the late Catherine Todd wasn't his biological mother, he sets off on a trek across the globe in search of his birth mom. He repeatedly crosses paths with a Joker, in a series of coincidences that strain credulity far beyond the suspension of disbelief comics already require, until the clown beats the boy nearly to death with a crowbar and then finishes the job with a bomb. Batman arrives too late. Jason is dead. Jason gets better. Reality-wrenching events of the series Infinite Crisis resurrect Jason inside his coffin. He claws his way out and up through the earth, only to emerge from his grave brain-damaged. His mind and personality do not fully return until Talia al Ghul immerses him in her father's Lazarus pit. Finally, fully restored, Jason is stunned to learn that the Joker still lives. That hurts. The question that sears at Jason is not how he came back from the dead, but why he has gone unavenged. Confused, disappointed, and angry at Batman, the young man adopts a new identity as the Red Hood, taking a name the Joker once used, and returns to Gotham as a brutally violent vigilante who also shakes down the mob. When Batman assumes Jason is angry that he failed to prevent this ex-Robin's death, Jason tells him, "Bruce, I forgive you for not saving me. But why? Why on God's earth is he still alive?" Jason, ignoring what he's done in the past, blindly, stupidly disregarding the entire graveyards he's filled, the thousands who have suffered, the friends he's crippled, I thought, killing me, that I'd be the last person you'd ever let him hurt. If it had been you that he beat to a bloody mass, if it had been you that he left in agony, if he had taken you from this world, I would have done nothing but search the planet for this pathetic pile of evil, death-worshipping garbage, and sent him off to hell. Diagnosis. When Batman first meets the boy, Jason shows behaviors associated with conduct disorder, a repetitive, persistent pattern of violating societal norms and the rights of others, but of no more than moderate severity. On the one hand, Jason chooses his lifestyle of fending for himself rather than becoming a ward of the state, while on the other hand, he is not out to hurt anyone. Severe conduct disorder would involve acts of cruelty or inflicting considerable harm. Behavior more heinous than truancy, running away or stealing to get by. At first, Jason readily adapts to his new role as Batman's partner and Bruce Wayne's son, and no longer shows any disruptive behavior disorder. But over the course of the next year, he becomes very moody, resentful, reckless, with a dangerously high level of aggressive energy to work off. And Batman worries that Jason's attitude is about to get him killed. Batman tells Alfred he may have started Jason as Robin before he had a chance to come to grips with his parents' deaths. Bouts of crying over his parents' photo, yet refusing to talk about it, together with his moodiness, may indicate that Jason has developed post-traumatic stress disorder. Anger and aggression may be the tools he's using to repel depression or feelings of guilt over having replaced his parents with his adoptive dad. The overall pattern of negativistic, hostile, and defiant behavior fits oppositional defiant disorder. Like conduct disorder, one of the disruptive behavior disorders. And this stubborn, disobedient pattern gets him killed. Technically, the grown Jason fits the criteria for antisocial personality disorder through his aggressiveness, deceitfulness, repeated unlawful behavior, and lack of remorse. Although we have to evaluate these in the context of the world in which he lives. Superheroes, like spies and undercover police, use aggression and deceit as tricks of the trade. He is a man on a mission. Like Marvel Comics' Punisher or Batman's inspiration, The Shadow, he slays evildoers. "I've killed, not murdered," he originally insists, although he also threatens that death may come to those who stand in my way of doing what's right. Judging him by the standards of normal society, even comparing him to superheroes, he still seems fairly antisocial. When authorities lock him in Arkham Asylum on the grounds that he will be safer there than in a prison's general population, he successfully petitions the court for transfer to Gotham City Corrections on the grounds that he is legally sane. Jason, to Batman, "I murdered criminals. Granted, I got dressed up in a goofy outfit to do it, but look in a mirror, Nosferatu. That doesn't get me in the rubber room. I have passed all of my psych exams, multiple times. I am simply homicidal. Will I kill again? Sure. Am I a bad person? Oh yeah. So keep me locked up. Just not here. I will not be housed in your kennel for freaks." and adopting his killer's old Red Hood nom de plume. Antihero Jason has taken from the life of a villain who took his life. He takes more from the Joker than that. Beyond his own mounting body count, and aside from giving the Joker some payback at the end of another crowbar, Jason is trying to teach people, especially Batman, some lessons. The Joker and Jason want Batman to break his rules. Both want substantiation for their respective opinions that rules and order do not work, although neither would keep seeking such support if fully secure in his beliefs. They're trying to tear down not Batman himself, but rather his restraint. They want to see his darkness unleashed. He is the standard by which they judge themselves. Unable to make sense of the world in which he lives, and unable to see the world as Batman does, Jason is trying to get Batman to see that Gotham is ugly, and that its most dangerous criminals need to die. Like the Joker, he tries to prove that people are uglier inside than Batman wants to believe. Were Batman to kill the Joker, he'd prove both the Joker and Jason right. Supposedly to teach Bruce the price of enlisting others' help in the conflict between Batman and the Red Hood, Jason abducts Green Arrow's sidekick. The former second Robin tells Mia Dearden, the second Speedy, "Tonight you're going to get some learning." He tries to get Mia to see how much she has in common with him so she might be better prepared to kill enemies when necessary to keep herself alive. Jason's lessons tend to be about the need to kill. Jason, to Mia, "My surrogate dad comes from the same damned upbringing as your self-righteous mentor. I'm like you. I was born out on the streets, too. I know that sometimes we have to do the bad things just to get by. And I know that sometimes very bad things have to be done to do a great right. I don't think either of our fathers will ever understand that. But you do." Whereas the Joker tries to reshape the world in his own image by imposing his visage upon his victims, equipment, and fish, Jason redefines himself to be like others. At different points in his life, he replaces Dick Grayson as Robin, assumes the Joker's old Red Hood identity, dons the Nightwing costume and name while Dick Grayson is on sabbatical with Bruce and Tim, traipses the multiverse in the costume of Earth 51 Batman's late partner Red Robin, and tries to win the right to wear his Batman's cowl when people think Bruce dead. After Dick wins that cowl and becomes Batman with Bruce's son Damian as his Robin, Jason transforms his Red Hood outfit into a more traditional superhero costume and gets his own sidekick, a girl called Scarlet. Later, as Bruce resumes his place as Gotham's one and only Batman, Jason follows and distorts another chapter from Bruce's life when he leads the Outlaws, the anti-hero equivalent of the Outsiders super team Batman sometimes leads. The Outlaws include former Teen Titans, notably Green Arrow's first sidekick and Dick Grayson's former girlfriend. Jason's repeated efforts to recast himself to fit other people's molds show some similarities to borderline personality disorder, previously discussed in connection with Batman Forever's Riddler, a condition involving a vague, poorly formed identity. While Jason may be too consistent in his actions, manner, and moods to fit that particular disorder well, spending much of his youth brain-damaged and comatose has made him miss out on a critical period in personality development. The greatest superhero backstories each include a defining moment. A rocket blasts off from a dying planet. A boy kneels crying over his slain parents. Another boy's parents fall when trapeze ropes break. A clown shoots and cripples the police commissioner's daughter. A teenager stares in shock at the face of the burglar who killed his Uncle Ben. Jason's defining moments, the events we always think of in connection with him, are of a boy stealing tires from the Batmobile and a clown, the same clown who shot the commissioner's daughter, later beating the boy to death with a crowbar. Just as readers cannot leave these moments behind, Jason, with no powerful redefining moment, also surely never will. Case File 10-2, Dr. Frederick Wortham. Real name, Frederick Wortham, originally Wertheimer, M.D. First appearance, Munich, Germany, March 20, 1895. Origin. This psychiatrist's 1954 book, Seduction of the Innocent, a condemnation of comic books as the root of much juvenile delinquency in America, rocked the comics industry and instigated many changes. Among other things, Wortham contended that Batman and Robin live out a homosexual fantasy, and people have kept talking about that ever since. Is Batman gay? No. Is Robin gay? No. But what about... No. To those who read the stories as written, these questions can seem stupid, in which case the greater question might be why people keep asking. That greater question could ignite considerable and fascinating debate while remaining objectively unanswerable. Comic book writer Alan Grant, one of numerous interviewees Silver Bullet Comics once surveyed regarding Batman's sexuality, said, "In my 40 years as a Batman reader, that question never occurred to me. Then, during my time as a writer on the Batman titles, I was interviewed for an American College rag. The first question was, is Batman gay? Well, the Batman I wrote for 13 years isn't gay. Denny O'Neil's Batman, Marv Wolfman's Batman, everybody's Batman all the way back to Bob Kane, none of them wrote him as a gay character. The Dark Knight Returns author Frank Miller has said, Batman isn't gay. His sexual urges are so drastically sublimated into crime fighting that there's no room for any other emotional activity. Notice how insipid are the stories where Batman has a girlfriend or some sort of romance. It's not because he's gay, but because he's borderline pathological. He's obsessive. He'd be much healthier if he were gay. DC Comics stories consistently present the Batman-Robin relationship as that of father and son, master and apprentice, mentor and mentee. Readers over the years have had fun pulling examples out of context, like a panel in which twin beds look like the same bed shared by both characters. But consider this. If we could generate over 100,000 panel images from your life, assorted snapshots displayed out of context, aren't there more than a few we could misinterpret in wildly creative ways? Popular discussion of the Caped Crusader's sexual orientation started with psychiatrist Dr. Frederick Wortham, who authored studies on homicide, helped pioneer courtrooms' use of expert witnesses on forensic psychiatry, provided information that helped the Supreme Court end school desegregation, judged comic books to be the root of mid-20th century juvenile delinquency, and shook the comic magazine industry to its foundation. Wortham studied under eminent psychiatrist Emil Kraepelin, worked with Adolf Meyer, and met with Sigmund Freud, all of whom exerted powerful influence over him, even though he ignored Freud's personal recommendation to keep psychiatry out of the popular press. A social reformer who fought for civil rights, Wortham immigrated to the United States after World War I and made his name as a consulting psychiatrist for the New York court system. His psychiatric clinic was among the first to provide psychiatric examinations for all convicted felons, and his recommendations helped lead to the modernization of many facilities and their methods. A charitable mental health clinic Wortham established in Harlem became the most successful in the nation to provide psychotherapy for the underprivileged, the only center in the city where both Negroes and whites may receive extended psychiatric care. Known in Harlem as Dr. Quarter, for the nominal fee he charged to encourage responsibility rather than administer service completely for free, Wortham kept this clinic open for about a decade, during which time he studied how segregation affected children and developed his ideas on how comic books, especially horror comics, cultivated juvenile delinquency. In the course of his work with juvenile offenders, Wortham noted how avidly delinquents read comic books and how excitedly they described the sometimes gory content, often in response to Wortham's leading questions. Because the delinquents had all read comic books, Wortham concluded that the comics exerted unhealthy influence. One of the many flaws in this reasoning is that Wortham did not measure them against a control group, comparison group, of non-delinquents, the greater flaw being that he did not systematically collect enough quantitative measurements. In the 1940s and early 1950s, when he made these observations, every delinquent child would also have seen baseball games, as would the non-delinquents, so why not blame baseball? After a child broke into a meat market so his companions would reward him with comic books and candy, why did Wortham blame the comic books instead of that wicked candy? Hardly the first to criticize comic books, but surely the most influential. Wortham started shaking things up with a 1948 Saturday Review of Literature article and grew increasingly more vocal, giving lectures and writing more articles over the next 7 years, culminating with his famous book, Seduction of the Innocent, in 1954. During hearings before the subcommittee to investigate juvenile delinquency of the Committee on the Judiciary, Wortham testified, "I think Hitler was a beginner compared to the comic book industry." Seduction of the Innocent focused on horror and crime comics, devoting only a small portion of the book to superheroes. But in that small portion lies some of the book's most famous content. Wortham called Superman a fascist, scoffed at letting children read stories that teach them the Green Lantern will help save them, said Batman and Robin lived a homosexual fantasy lifestyle, and called Wonder Woman the lesbian counterpart of Batman. He never called Batman and Robin gay. He said their lifestyle was like a wish dream of two homosexuals living together. Wortham inferred a homoerotic subtext that the character's creators never intended, a charge as easily leveled against other popular stories about men sharing adventures with their fellow men, e.g. war movies, cowboy movies, The Three Musketeers, The Three Stooges. Only someone ignorant of the fundamentals of psychiatry and the psychopathology of sex can fail to realize a subtle atmosphere of homoeroticism which pervades the adventures of the mature Batman and his young friend Robin. These Freudian fundamentals to which he refers, especially early psychoanalytic views on the psychopathology of sex, remain controversial among a majority of psychological professionals and inadequately supported by empirical study. "At home, they lead an idyllic life," Wortham said of the lifestyle Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson enjoy, "in sumptuous quarters, with beautiful flowers and large vases, and have a butler, Alfred." To avoid being thought queer by Wortham, Andy Medhurst, like others, suggests that Bruce and Dick needed to never show concern if the other is hurt, live in a shack, only have ugly flowers and small vases, call the butler Chip or Joe, if you have to have one at all, never share a couch, keep your collar buttoned up, keep your jacket on, and never, ever wear a dressing gown. Wortham complained about villains taking Robin hostage, not because that depicted child endangerment, which would have been a valid concern about Batman's relationship with Robin, but instead because he found something inherently sexual in the act of rescuing one's friends, a staple in adventure stories through any medium. Just as he says, "They constantly rescue each other from violent attacks by an unending number of enemies. The feeling is conveyed that we men must stick together because there are so many villainous creatures who have to be exterminated." When describing how the Batman type of story helps to fixate homoerotic tendencies, he complains that where Batman is anti-feminine, the attractive Wonder Woman and her friends are definitely anti-masculine. Wonder Woman has her own female following. They are all continuously threatened, captured, almost put to death. There is a great deal of mutual rescuing, the same type of rescue fantasies as in Batman. Dismissing strong good girl characters like intrepid reporter Vicki Vale, Wortham carped, "In these stories, there are practically no decent, attractive, successful women. A typical female character is the Catwoman, who is vicious and uses a whip. The atmosphere is homosexual and anti-feminine. If the girl is good-looking, she is undoubtedly the villainess." Some truth may hover in there, for reasons other than Wortham's perceived homosexual subtext. Bob Kane distrusted women. Batman's creator, who enjoyed dating women like Marilyn Monroe, didn't know how to befriend them. "You always need to keep a woman at arm's length. We don't want anyone to take over our souls, and women have a habit of doing that," Kane said in his autobiography. "With women, when the romance is over, somehow they never remain my friends." By paving the way for the creation of the Comics Code Authority as a tool for the comic book industry to regulate its own content, a code Wortham himself neither supported nor endorsed, as he objected to censorship and felt pessimistic about the comic book company's ability to regulate themselves, Wortham's campaign for parents to take responsibility and supervise their children's reading got Catwoman evicted from the comics for more than a decade. Never mind the whip. That she could have gone without. The code, by forbidding suggestive postures, demanding realistic drawings,